No sleep till Friday. Welcome back to the DenverBroncos.com podcast. It's a short turnaround this week, going from the Sunday game straight into preparation for Thursday's game, and that's not just for the players. We've got the podcast live earlier this week to get y'all the analysis and news you want before the game. Before we get into the meat and potatoes, here's the news. Naturally, the biggest news item was the history made during the game against the 49ers, with Peyton Manning's 509th touchdown pass, and then the 510th one. We had a multitude of NFL legends past and present offering their kind words and congratulations videos on the site, from Y.A. Tittle to Brett Favre to Drew Brees to Tony Dungy and more. It was a joyous moment for Manning, and it was made all the happier coming in a big win over a tough team. But we'll expound upon this later when Andrew Mason joins me to review the game. That milestone for Manning was seen by a lot of people. In fact, according to NBC, they had about 24 million viewers, their most of any telecast this season. Denver had the top market, followed by Sacramento and San Francisco. In more recent news, the Broncos have made a couple roster moves, signing running back Capri Bibbs to the active roster from the practice squad after waiving Shaquille Barrett. Taking a look around the NFL, the Cowboys maintain their status atop the league with a win over the Giants in the 31-21 home win. DeMarco Murray has yet to rush for fewer than 100 yards in a game this season, and he now leads the league in rushing with 913 yards. The closest challenger, Le'Veon Bell, has 542 yards, so that's a big difference. Along with Dallas, the Broncos are joined by the Cardinals as the only teams left with a single loss. In other league-leading news, the Broncos' pass rush is crushing it. Von Miller leads the NFL in sacks with 8, and DeMarcus Ware is tied for second with 7. Their 15 sacks are the most for any duo, and would place them tied for 16th among entire NFL teams. And while I'm on the topic of Broncos defensive linemen, I caught up with Terrence Knighton after practice on Tuesday to talk about a habit that he's had ever since his days in Jacksonville.
One day I was just, standing on the sideline. I was just playing catch with a kid, and I was walking away with the ball. He was like, "Can I have the ball?" And I was like, "Yeah." He had the biggest smile on his face. I think I had a really good game that game. So after that, I just decided I'll just do that every week. And, whether it's home or away, I look for a Bronco fan or a kid. And you just don't know sometimes the effect that has on the kid. You know what I mean? Like, that kid I was playing catch with could be the next Peyton Manning just because of that moment. So, as a child, I didn't have that. I didn't have the means to be at an NFL game or to be around professional athletes where I grew up at. So I just know that it would have meant a lot to me as a child to see that, and it probably would have kept me out of trouble. But I just want to pass that on to other kids that that have the opportunity and don't have the opportunity. Whenever I get a chance, I talk to a lot of young kids. I still even go back to Jacksonville, and I'm still active in that community. So once I build relationships with people, and especially kids that don't have people to look up to and don't have the means to, experience things, I try to be much of a blessing as I can. You want to focus just on football, but you also got to see, the impact that you can have on people's lives doing what we do.
If you've ever interacted with Knighton, this moment just speaks to his character. Now, we'll have a full written piece along with photos that'll go up on DenverBroncos.com this weekend. Be sure to check back for that story. And now, without further ado, let's recap the Broncos' win over San Francisco from Sunday night. I'm not even sure what to say after a game like that. It was a very thorough beatdown. Manning got his record-setting score in the second quarter, and the offense followed up the 21-10 first half by doubling their scoring in the third quarter alone. Ronnie Hillman had an effective day, scoring twice, and the passing offense found unabated success. Manning threw for as many touchdowns as incomplete passes. Demaryius Thomas had an exceptional day with 171 yards, and Emmanuel Sanders finally got his first score of the season. But it was also an outstanding game defensively. The pass rush continued their run of punishing quarterbacks for having the gall to try to get anything on them. Ware had 3 sacks, Von Miller had 2, and Malik Jackson had 1. Colin Kaepernick didn't find much room to run, and the 49ers offense had to abandon the run game to look to score quickly through the air. But the secondary didn't give them that much room. Aqib Talib had a pick, and Kaepernick completed just 24 of his 39 passing attempts. The Broncos defense also held the 49ers to just 3 third down conversions on 23 attempts. By the time the clock wound down to 0 in the fourth quarter, the final score was 42-17. Our columnist Andrew Mason joins me now to break down some of the finer points of this game. With a quarterback as mobile as Kaepernick, how difficult a challenge was it for the defense to make San Francisco's offense one-dimensional?
Well, not as difficult as it would have been if Mike Iupati had played. I mean, they being without him really messed up what the 49ers wanted to do on the offensive line. That meant that you had to double one of the defensive tackles that was rushing for the Broncos, and that left one-on-ones on the outside, and that helped create a lot of sacks. So really, if it had been a healthy San Francisco offensive line, I'm not sure the win-loss result would have been different, but I'm certain that the margin of victory would have been different. I think they would have been able to accomplish a lot more on offense, and Kaepernick would have been much less comfortable. And I think they would have gotten the running game going with Frank Gore and Carlos Hyde a little bit better than they did. They had to abandon that in part because of the game flow and in part because it wasn't effective. So, a very good game for the Broncos, did a lot of things right in the pass rush, but you also have to consider this was a weak offensive line that was further hindered by injuries during the game.
Terrence Knighton mentioned that they'd like to get rid of some of the lapses they had. They did allow that last-minute drive in the second quarter, and that was the thing he was talking about. Is fixing this just a matter of execution, or what's the deal?
Well, that particular drive, it's not only execution, but I think the entire stadium was having a little bit of a hangover from Peyton Manning having hit the 509 touchdown mark on the previous drive. It was almost, there was a pause in the game. There was a little bit of celebration, a little bit of commemoration. And I think the defense, kind of softened up a little bit, particularly when they had the 49ers in some long yardage. So that's, it's good to see Knighton and the defense frustrated about that. They're looking for that perfect game. And while they had a great game on Sunday, I think they feel that perfect game or close to it for them is still in the future. They still feel like they have a ways to go. And I know also some of the reserves were frustrated about letting Blaine Gabbert and the backup offense score and making it 42-17 instead of 42-10. So I think there's just enough from that game for the defense to work on and keep focused and keep on edge going forward.
Now, you talked about the hangover after Peyton Manning's 509 moment. And what a moment that was. Flashes went up from cameras and phones, and the big video board had a great compilation of messages from NFL legends and teammates. How special was it watching Manning's 509 moment?
I think for everyone who's covered football for a long time that was in the press box, it's going to be a highlight of their careers to see that. I mean, there's very few records that when they were broken had that kind of fanfare and significance when they happened. I mean, I think back a little bit to Walter Payton in 1984 when he broke Jim Brown's rushing record. To a lesser degree, Emmitt Smith when he broke Payton's record in 2002. I think those are the moments that kind of compare to that. And there were some others. I remember when Steve Largent broke the receiving touchdown record that was held for 44 years by Don Hutson. He did that in a game in 1989 in Cincinnati. But unfortunately for him, it was on the road, so it didn't really get the proper commemoration, I think, from the Riverfront Stadium crowd and game presentation, whereas Manning doing it at home, you're able to go all out, you're able to have the commemorations, have the messages on the scoreboard, from other quarterbacks and guys like, of course, hearing from Brett Favre, whose record was broken. It had such a powerful meaning. If you follow the game of football, you follow how it has evolved. I think the touchdown pass mark is kind of that holy grail now of records. Maybe it's what rushing yardage used to be as far as the one record that stands above all the others. And the interesting thing now is that Manning's going to get a chance to add to that. He's already up to 510 with the touchdown pass to Demaryius Thomas. And like Jacob Tammy said after the game, every touchdown catch pass is going to be a record for Manning going forward. And I think the interesting question is, when the final number is in, who's going to have the last one? That's something that's going to have great meaning as well, although we may not know it when it's happening.
I also think a lot of the meaning itself is in Manning's devotion to the game. You ask anyone who works with him, they talk about his level of preparation, how focused he is every game. It's just to another level. I think putting himself atop the record books just speaks a lot to that in that moment. Really showed, some emotion for him, even though he doesn't do that a whole lot.
And not only does he put a lot in every game, there's probably no quarterback that has a keener sense of the history of it. You know, I'm not sure every quarterback who is playing in the game today would have the same sense of reverence and awe at seeing messages from guys like Y.A. Tittle and Sonny Jurgensen and Fran Tarkenton. But those are kind of the guys that Manning grew up hearing bedtime stories about, so to speak, from his dad, who also was a great NFL quarterback, Archie Manning. So I think for him, it has more resonance than it would for anybody else, just because not only, like you say, the way he works, but also because no one knows the game of the history, I think, among NFL players quite like Peyton Manning does.
Next up is the Thursday night game against the Chargers. But before we get into that, let's take a look at what the Chargers did last week, as well as the rest of the division, in our AFC West rundown. David, Warren, thanks for joining me again today. It was a big weekend in the AFC West, with the Chargers falling to the Chiefs in divisional play in a bit of a surprise after the recent winning streak. In less surprising news, the Raiders lost their sixth straight game, falling to the Cardinals. Our correspondent, Warren Giudice, has been following the Raiders for us this season. The quest for a single win marches on. Was there anything new to the way they lost this one against the Cardinals?
Well, like last week, they actually kept this game pretty close. The Cardinals took a 14-0 lead, but the Raiders scored 13 unanswered points and kept it relatively close most of the game and only lost 24-13, which, I mean, against the Cardinals really isn't something to be embarrassed about. I mean, they're an excellent team, top of the NFC West. But we'll start with the offense. You know, the offensive line last week was great in both pass protection and the run block, but this week they could really only muster up one aspect of their game, and they only allowed one sack of Derek Carr, which brings their season total to just 5 sacks allowed, and that puts them at the top of the NFL. But, I mean, other than that, their offensive sits at the bottom quarter of most offensive stats, including 32nd in yards accumulated per game. And, you know, Derek Carr's 55-yard completion to Bryce Butler was another great long connection between the two, but that was really the highlight for them offensively. And Carr finished 16 for 28 with 173 yards. And James Jones is kind of continuing to progress slowly and definitely becoming a go-to target for him. And he caught at least 4 passes for the 3rd straight game. And tough turning point for this offense was when they were unable to convert when their defense was able to pick off a Cardinals quarterback for the first time this season. But they couldn't get in the end zone on that series. On that series, they started at the Cardinals' 13-yard line, and McFadden ran for 2 yards and Carr threw incomplete twice. But you know, the rushing game was something that really broke out last week against the Chargers, but it just couldn't get it together. Darren McFadden led them with 48 yards on 14 attempts, and they only had 56 total yards on the ground, which definitely is not enough when you've got a rookie quarterback who is still learning the ropes. Defensively, it's pretty much the same story as last week. They just could not get off the field. Well, the highlight for the Raiders was Charles Woodson's interception of a pass deflected from Carson Palmer, and he returned it for 30 yards. And amazingly, that was the first interception by an Arizona Cardinals quarterback this season. You know, they've had some quarterback injuries and backups playing, but the Raiders were the first team to get it done. But other than that, you know, this Raiders defense, they really can't stop the run or the pass, and they can't get off the field. The Cardinals' rushing attack was all over them, and they racked up 123 yards, including 88 yards for Andre Ellington. Carson Palmer really picked apart the Raiders secondary, and he finished 22 of 31 for 253 yards and 2 touchdowns. So the Cardinals offense was on the field for just under 37 minutes, and you've got a defense that isn't very good at being on the field a lot, does not bode well. The Raiders only had 4 possessions in the second half, and they scored a field goal, punted twice, and the end of the game put an end to their final possession. And third down is really making a big difference for the Raiders, both offensively and defensively. You know, the Raiders are last in the league in third down percentage on defense, with nearly 53% of opponents' third down attempts being converted. And in this game, offensively, they were 4 of 12, which obviously kept them off the field. And then the Cardinals were 9 of 15. A bright spot for the Raiders, go special teams. Sebastian Janikowski made his 350th field goal of his his career in the game. So they've got that going for them.
I guess when you're 0-6, what you're looking for from a team as a fan, as a member of the front office or coaching staff, is how well your young players are playing, you know, building towards the future. And the centerpiece of that right now is Derek Carr, their rookie quarterback. We saw him have a pretty terrific game against the Chargers last week, a great team they were facing, and this week they came in and faced another good team against the Cardinals, but he didn't do nearly quite as well. Was this a little bit of Icarus falling back to earth?
I think so. You know, these Cardinals have a very good defense, and I think, you know, he finished 16 of 28 for 173 yards, and I mean, that's a drastic drop off from last week. And something we've definitely learned about Derek Carr is that he's pretty fearless, and he ended last week's game with a pretty bold pass and started Sunday's game in the same fashion against the Chargers. The Raiders were driving downfield with the potential to tie, and he sent a pass deep downfield intended for Bryce Butler, but it was intercepted by Jason Verrett, and that sealed the win for the Chargers. And against the Cardinals, he threw towards Patrick Peterson, an All-Pro, and he hasn't, in the past, fell incomplete, but he hasn't been shying away from excellent receivers. And, you know, based on how their defense is playing, that's how this offense is going to have to play, and in order to give them a chance to win. And, you know, Carr is getting very little support from the rushing attack, and that really closes some doors for them in the passing game. And you know, his aggressiveness kept the Raiders in the game last weekend with the Chargers, and he had 4 touchdown passes. But other than that one 55-yard pass, he mostly kept the passes short, and like I said, third down, 4 for 12, and he was only on the field for 23 minutes. Matt Schaub made his Raiders debut, and as he came on special teams to hold for Janikowski on a field goal attempt and an extra point attempt. You know, it looks like Carr's the guy, and I think Tony Sparano really has faith in him. I know Tony Sparano definitely seems to have faith in Carr and will be patient as he develops, and I say this every week, I think. You can't blame Carr for 0-6. The weapons around him are not producing as much as they need to be to support this rookie and kind of help him find success and help his team find success. And success is definitely going to be difficult for this team to find as they continue through one of the toughest schedules in the NFL. They travel to Cleveland next week, which is probably their best shot for a win this season. And then lucky them, it's on to Seattle, Denver, and San Diego. So it's definitely a tough schedule for these Raiders as they try and climb their way out of an 0-6 hole.
Elsewhere in the division, the Chiefs earned a hard-fought victory over the then-division-leading Chargers, 23-20. Our other correspondent, David Deschant, has been following San Diego each week, and I've been keeping an eye on Kansas City. From the Chiefs' side, I thought they played a smart game on both sides of the ball. They established the run well with Jamaal Charles early, and the defense executed consistently on third down to force San Diego into 4 punts in their first 5 drives. They did have some mistakes, much of which were made much worse by penalties. Were it not for a drop pass in the seam, the Chiefs probably would not have given up a touchdown on the following Chargers drive to end the first half. Still, they closed it out in the second half, controlling the ball nearly the entire third quarter on an 11-play, 86-yard drive ending in a touchdown. Though the Chargers would tie it up late 20-20 with a couple field goals, the Chiefs had another drive in them. They start on their own 8-yard line after a holding penalty on the kickoff return, but then an Alex Smith scramble got an extra 15 yards because of a face mask penalty. After a first down to Dwayne Bowe for 15 yards and an incomplete pass that put them into fourth down, they brought in their rookie kicker, Cairo Santos, for a 48-yard attempt. He made it with just a little room to spare, and then on the ensuing drive, Philip Rivers threw a pick, and that was that.
Yeah, you know, it came down to that final field goal by the Chiefs, and then kind of a last-second heave from Philip Rivers to decide the game, but it didn't feel like the game was that close. The Chiefs really outplayed the Chargers in this game. I thought the Chargers were fortunate in some ways. Like you mentioned, the key drops, the Chiefs had a couple of those on third down. They had one that perhaps could have gone up the middle, Junior Hemingway for a touchdown. Dwayne Bowe had a bad drop on third down. And like you said, they turned it around, the Chargers did, and got a touchdown to Antonio Gates just before halftime on a 27-yarder. Even that touchdown was a little fortunate. It was tipped on the way in. Frankly, if the ball bounces differently, could have been tipped for an interception. So really a little fortunate there. They also got fortunate when A.J. Jenkins, the Chiefs wide receiver, went up the sideline with a nice move and just inconceivably stepped out of bounds with nobody near him. He was gone down the sidelines. Eventually they turned that drive into a touchdown, but that's an explosive play that the Chargers were lucky not to give up, and yet they didn't take advantage of it in this game. So yeah, really it felt like the Chiefs dominated the game with 39 minutes time of possession, moved the ball well, and came out on top despite the Chargers' luck.
Last game we kind of saw some hints that their five-game win streak might come to an end soon after they barely beat the Raiders by 3 points. Did you think the Chiefs exploited some of those weaknesses we saw in the last game?
Definitely they did. We've talked about how the center position in San Diego is really in rough shape. Rich Ornberger, their second center, is playing right now. Been dealing with a bad back, but he's playing. He did not play well in this game. Dontari Poe really, abused him up the middle, forced Phillip Rivers off the spot, and we've seen that the biggest thing Phillip Rivers struggles with is pressure directly up the middle, like most quarterbacks. Nonetheless, Phillip Rivers, who's been remarkably consistent this year and accurate and precise, was just a little off. I think we both saw that. I think a little bit of an overthrow here, a bit of a rushed throw there. Lots of missed throws, and that led to only about 200 yards passing for Phillip Rivers. Another weakness that the Chargers, we've talked about a little bit, it seemed like they'd shored it up a little bit, but their red zone offense hasn't been perfect. They're middle of the league right now, I think, despite being the second best team on third down. So in this game, they were 1-for-2. That field goal, obviously, if it were a touchdown, would have been a big deal. Interestingly, the kind of other thing that the Chargers have been really bad at is red zone defense. Just looked this up today. They're dead last in the league in red zone defense. They allowed 2 touchdowns in 3 attempts this week to the Chiefs, but they're allowing touchdowns 75% of the time to opposing offenses. That's something you got to shore up. As far as weaknesses that they didn't really show again this week, their pass rush picked it up. Playing against a worse offensive line surely helped. But they had 3 sacks. They moved Alex Smith around throughout the day, made him work. They had another sack that was nullified by a holding penalty in the secondary. So that was definitely an improvement there. Other quick positives, Brandon Oliver, we've talked about him, had another good game. They didn't have great rushing stats overall because they didn't run that often. But he averaged 4.5 yards carry, showed good power. Corey Legit, their defensive end, had a really disruptive game, had a sack. Blew up a few running plays, although he did commit the face mask you talked about earlier on Alex Smith's scramble that kind of started the Chiefs' game-winning drive. Another positive, Keenan Allen, a little more involved in this game, 10 targets. He did only have 58 yards on 6 catches. I think that has to do with him getting a lot of comeback routes, curls, some drags here and there, an out route. Not really targeting him deep right now, but good to see him involved if you're a Chargers fan. Ben, it looked like the Chiefs' offense was just very steady in this game. Lots of long drives, solid passing, solid running. What did you see from them?
Well, yeah, they established the run pretty well early. Since they discovered that Niall Davis is, an effective back they can bring in to sub in for Jamaal Charles, they've used him really well. It's not necessarily like a thunder and lightning kind of thing, but they're both just effective backs that can continue to pick up where they leave off. Even in the first half, they had some drives that didn't go anywhere in the first quarter. They still used them pretty well, and that worked out great for them later in the game. They converted well on third downs. It seems like even though they had some mistakes, some drops there, they just executed when they needed to. They converted half of their third downs as compared to the Chargers, who converted only 3 of 10. And another thing that really got them going was field position. They started out at the 28-yard line, which was better than the Chargers, who started out at their 20 on average. Kansas City they got some good returns out of DeAnthony Thomas. They pinned San Diego back a little bit and forced them to punt from their own end zone, and that gave them some good field position. And even when they got pinned back in their own deep territory, they sustained these large drives that ended in a scoring drive. They had 2 drives that started within their own 10, and the second was the game-winning drive for a field goal. It started on their own 8, They got some help from penalties. They got some hurt from penalties because they had that holding that put them inside their own 10. But still, they went down the field. They got some big plays from Alex Smith. His scramble was key. Dwayne Bowe had a nice catch for 15 yards on a 2nd and 15. Those kind of plays, they just got them when they needed them. As you said, it would have been a bigger lead had they gotten some of those other ones that just slipped through their hands. But ultimately, they came out on top, and that's what matters. This game really shook things up a lot for the AFC West, at least for the Chargers. You know, they were in control of their own destiny atop the division, and now they slip down to 2nd behind the Broncos, who now take that control of the division. Overall, what do you see this game meaning for San Diego moving forward?
Well, it's a big loss. It's hard to get around that. I mean, they would have loved to come into Denver with the division lead and really forcing the Broncos to take it from them, whereas now the Broncos are the team ahead. They have position moving forward, and if they win this Thursday night game, they're really going to have position. The Chargers are going to be hard-pressed to catch them. They'll certainly have to beat them in San Diego if they can't beat them in Denver on Thursday night. That'll be tough. Again, they're traveling on a short week. Thursday night games are not easy. We've seen that in the past. They're playing a team that's coming off, I would say, certainly its most dominant victory of the year. Great performance all around, and that's challenging. The Chargers are also beaten up. I mean, in this game, Jason Verrett, their rookie corner, missed the game. Manti Te'o missed the game. They've had several other people out. Melvin Ingram is on injured reserve with designation return and so on. Brandon Flowers, their top cornerback, got hurt in this game. Got a concussion on a really violent hit with his old teammate Jamal Charles in the end zone as Jamal Charles was scoring, but he may not play in this game, especially because it's on the short week. So that it'll be a challenge for the Chargers. What we've seen from them so far is that their defense has been better than expected. So we'll see how they handle the Broncos offense. In fact, their defense and the Broncos defense are very similar right now. They're 0.2 yards apart in yardage allowed on the year. The Chargers are 5th, Denver 6th. However, Denver's 2nd in yards per play, whereas San Diego is 12th by virtue of facing fewer drives. So we'll see how the defenses shake out in this game. We'll see if Phillip Rivers can get back on track. And it'll be interesting to see what Mike McCoy does in his now 4th game against his old team.
The Chiefs themselves, you know, they weren't really expected to do much after losing some big players on their defense, but they're in a pretty good spot. You know, they've won some games that they might not have been expected to win. New England comes to mind. This one comes to mind. But they face St. Louis coming up. That might be a tougher game than we might have thought. If St. Louis doesn't beat Seattle, we might be kind of thinking this is a win, but now it's not so sure. Still, they're in this race. They're 3-3 right now. If they win against St. Louis, they're 4-3. And then should the Chargers lose to the Broncos, you know, who knows, they'll be sitting at 5-3. And with the Chargers having a bye coming up, eventually the Chiefs can make up ground there for them and they could move into second place. There's a lot of ifs there, but still, they're in a better spot than we might have thought after the first week or two. Now from here, let's move forward looking to the Chargers going this Thursday, playing the Broncos. Big matchup. I've got Andrew Mason here with us to talk about it. Now, we've already taken a look back at the Chargers last week, and if you've been paying attention to the division, or even just our weekly recaps of it, you know the Chargers can be a dangerous team. They're 6th in passing yards per game, and 2nd overall in passing yards per play. They've got a low interception rate, and they execute very well on third down with a conversion rate of about 51.5%. Defensively, they're 5th in overall yards per game allowed, including a top 3 ranking in passing yards per game allowed. After playing teams that rather excel in rush defense, they've played the numbers 1, 5, 6, 8, and 9 in terms of NFL rankings in rush defense yards per game. The Broncos face the Chargers' rush defense, which is in the middle of the pack. Is this another good chance for Hillman to continue his good run of play?
It is, especially if the Broncos can get out in front early. Now, that being said, given the issues the Chargers have in the secondary right now being banged up, Brandon Flowers coming off a concussion, Jason Verrett's been dealing with a shoulder problem the last couple weeks and didn't play last Sunday. it's certainly setting up to where the Broncos may, you know, try to strike and build a lead through the air and then set up on the ground. That can lead to success for Hillman. We saw that on Sunday against San Francisco, really getting the passing game going early, and then, you know, on in the late second quarter and the third quarter, really pounding it down the 49ers' throats. And that's, of course, when Hillman had his breakaway run for a touchdown. That's the longest one the Broncos have had this year. So I think Hillman can have a big night, but it's all going to depend on what the Broncos can do early. Can they use the passing game to build a lead and get that lead to two or three scores? And if that's the case, then I think you're going to see Hillman have some big numbers. If it's a tight game, I think the Broncos are going to keep on throwing, because right now, given the personnel issues, if Flowers doesn't play Thursday, if Verrett is limited, then that's where the Chargers' weakness is going to be.
Real quick, what did you think of the Broncos moving Paul Kornick into that starting spot on the line?
Well, it worked, I think, to go to the point of the previous question. I think it helped Ronnie Hillman and also Juwan Thompson out. I think Kornick brings a little more power in the run game. I think we saw some struggles early. He had a false start. He had a play where he got beat by Aaron Lynch for the sack of Peyton Manning, and also was beaten by Lynch on the 509th touchdown pass. And, you know, Manning just managed to get the ball away in time before Lynch arrived and hit Demaryius Thomas. So pass protection, I think, is going to be an issue. It's something he needs to work on. But he did get better with time, and I think the confidence that he showed in the run game, he's got a little bit of a road grader type of a style to him. I think, you know, that's something the Broncos can work with, and you just want to see him adapt to what he's facing in terms of pass rush and get more technically sound. And that may well come with time, and I think it'll be interesting to see where Kornick is after another two or three games. And if he's made that development as a pass rusher, then the Broncos will be pretty happy with the change. But right now, I think it's just going to be week by week, seeing what he has and monitoring it closely.
Now, the Chargers have plenty of injuries that could be holding them back. They've still been one of the best teams in the league despite all these injuries. How have they overcome it?
Their offensive line is improving, particularly in run blocking. That's why you're seeing them able to plug a guy like Oliver in and get some results. The other thing to consider, the schedule got soft for 4 weeks. I mean, they had a tough opening with Arizona and Seattle, and they split those two. And then after that, it was Buffalo, Jacksonville, the Jets, and the Raiders. Well, that's the kind of stretch that is going to allow you to get hot if you play pretty well, and they did. And then Kansas City, you know, coming in there, I don't think it was a case of looking ahead to Thursday. I think really the Chiefs are improving, and they were able to exact their will on the game, particularly on the ground. So really now I'm curious to see what the Chargers do going forward, getting into a tougher stretch of their schedule. Otherwise, you know, if they lose Thursday, you're going to look at them and say they're 5-3, but they're 1-3 against teams that are considered legitimate playoff contenders. And I think there's going to be a lot of questions in San Diego about them getting fat off of a weaker opposition if they don't get it done Thursday night.
As you mentioned in the previous podcast, covering tight ends has been a bit of a problem for the Broncos in recent history. Going against one of the best in the past decade against Antonio Gates, how should they look to contain him?
Team effort. I think you change the looks you throw at him. You change the men assigned to him. You know, I think sometimes you'll see Bradley Roby in there, and he's holding his own when he has to go against bigger targets. Sometimes you use a linebacker, sometimes you use a safety, sometimes you're gonna attack Phillip Rivers and put enough pressure on him to where he doesn't find that gap in the zone that Gates is running. And that's something we saw Arizona do back in week one, is they put a heavy rush on Rivers, and then Gates had some space, but they were, you know, you count on the rush on Rivers to force a slightly inaccurate throw. And I think we'll see some of that. I think you do a lot of different things to try to contain him. But at the same time, you know, let's face it, I mean, 7 touchdowns already this season in 7 games. I mean, he's been right up there with Julius Thomas as the most effective tight end in the red zone this year. And I think if you just go with a tactic of putting one guy on him, I think they're going to exploit that. So you want to change the looks and change things up and maybe try to, you know, if not confuse them and confuse Gates, catch him a little bit off guard to where he doesn't know where coverage is coming from and he doesn't know where contact is coming from.
Another week, another top 5 passing defense. Would the Chargers be able to throw something at the Broncos that they haven't seen to this point?
Well, they can throw the pass rusher that knows Peyton Manning best. Of course, Dwight Freeney is there, and he was injured last year, but he's come back. He has a couple of sacks this year. Corey Leggett has 2.5 sacks. The thing with the Chargers pass rush is that it comes from a lot of directions. You know, you look at them, and I mean, I'm just looking at their stat sheet right now. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 different players have sacks so far this year, have at least a half a sack for them. That shows you how much they lean on blitzes, how much they try to disguise coverages. I mean, you're gonna see them, you know, bring safeties forward. You're gonna see all linebackers involved in the pass rush. They try to confuse the opponent, not let them know where the rush is coming from. They did some of that last year when they came in, especially when they came in for the Thursday night game and beat the Broncos 27-20. They were, you know, they mixed up their pass rushes, mixed up their coverages, and I think confused the Broncos a little bit. So that's what they can show, just a lot of different looks, and it's going to be key for Peyton Manning, you know, to identify the looks at the snap and then adapt to that. And if he does, then the offense should be okay. But if not, we may see some mistakes and sometimes where it bogs down like it did last year on a Thursday night.
All right, Mace, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Now go get some rest before Thursday. And that goes for everyone else, too. The game's at 6:25 Mountain Time on CBS and NFL Network. For those going to the game, there is a special event going on beforehand. The Orange Ride will begin with a pregame pep rally from 3 to 4 in front of the Denver City and County Building downtown on Bannock Street. Bring your bike because the ride will start at 4:30 and head towards Sports Authority Field at Mile High, where they'll hold a pregame tailgate party. For those without tickets to the game, the ride will go back towards the city to watch the matchup between the Broncos and the Chargers at Tavern Downtown. Thanks for tuning into our DenverBroncos.com podcast. As always, you can find us on the site or on iTunes. We'll be back with you next week. Thanks for listening.